You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the October 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by finishing The Shortwave Listener by Fred Waterer. October Shortwave Listening Fair. The Espacio Lejano ground station has a powerful 16-story antenna with an 8-foot barbed wire fence that surrounds the entire compound. With other facilities in countries from Bolivia to Peru, do China's space ambitions cross the known world and aim for intergalactic exploration, rare mineral discovery, and potential domination in space? Landing on the far side of the moon in 2019 and again in 2024 has marked a key milestone in China's push to become a dominant space power. And with plans to land astronauts on the moon by 2030 and build a research base on its South Pole, China's ambitions in our solar system have been gaining momentum. Katie Watson asks astronomers, space engineers, and Argentinian residents, how is President Xi's Space Silk Road impacting their universe? BBC World Service, Thursday, September 26, 0930. Crowd science. The moon and Earth are drifting gradually further apart. Every year, the gap between them increases by a few centimeters. We know that the moon's gravity has an important effect on Earth, from controlling the tides to affecting the planet's rotation. But slowly, imperceptibly, over billions of years, that influence will diminish as the moon moves away. For crowd science listener Tony in the UK, that idea poses another question. What if we were to look back in time? What effects did the moon have when it was closer to Earth? Would it counteract the planet's gravity more so that at the time of the dinosaurs, a brontosaurus would weigh a little less than it would if it existed now? It's an intriguing question, and given that it involves both the moon and dinosaurs, it's one that has got presenter Anand Chagatia really excited. He starts by considering how the moon was formed in the first place, and discovers one of the most dramatic events in the early history of our solar system when two worlds collided. He talks to Professor Neil Comins, author of the book, What If the Moon Didn't Exist?, about a time when the newly formed moon would have dominated the night sky. And he explores the effects of the moon's gravity on Earth, trying to work out if it might have made a dinosaur lighter. Of course, it helps to know what a dinosaur weighed in the first place. Anand turns to paleontologist Nicholas Campione, who's been puzzling over the most accurate way to calculate the bulk of a brontosaurus. BBC World Service, Friday, September 27th, 2024. WRMI Halloween Treat. WRMI Radio Miami International will be treating you again this Halloween season with Autumn Time Tales of Edgar Allan Poe. The trick to hearing Morella read in an old-time radio style is to tune to 15,770 kHz, 1300 UTC, or 9,395 kHz, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, on Saturdays after mid-October. A special surprise may also be included in your trick-or-treat bag, as rumors of H.P. Lovecraft's The Haunter of the Dark may also make its appearance. After all, Roderick Usher of Poe's Fall of the House of Usher is mentioned at the end of this frightening story. Listen October 19th and 26th. And now Radio 101 by Ken Reitz, KS4ZR. KS4ZR numeral 1 at gmail.com. The Lost Art of QSLing. Like most newly minted hams of decades ago, as soon as I received my call sign, I immediately ordered QSL cards from a well-known QSL card printer who advertised in the pages of QST. Unbelievably, there was a typo in the call sign, so they were worthless, and I had to have them reprinted. More weeks dragged by before I could start exchanging QSLs. Printing 250 at a time, I had gone through several printings before I noticed that the printer had attached the wrong grid square to my location. There's always something to contend with. A few weeks ago, I received a self-addressed stamped envelope, SASE, from the ARRL's incoming QSL bureau that contained three QSL cards, two from Sweden and one from Belgium. All three were contacts I had made during an experiment I did several years ago at the depth of the previous solar cycle, during the depth of the summer propagation doldrums. Operating under those conditions, I further imposed a 50-watt limit on my output and used only a wire antenna in an attempt to work 100 DXCC entities via SSB in 90 days. I came pretty close. As a licensed U.S. amateur operator, you can use the ARRL's incoming QSL bureau without being an ARRL member. To use the outgoing QSL bureau, you'll need to be a member. The following web address will acquaint you with all the details of using this service. ARRL.org/incoming-QSL-service. It's important to follow the directions when using either service. When your district bureau sends your last SASE, someone will write on it, "Last envelope." That's your cue to send more SASEs as directed on the website. Always use Forever U.S. Postage because rates increase without notice and the Bureau will not add the missing postage to send your incoming overseas QSLs to you. What's the hurry? If you have been paying attention to U.S. postal rates over the last few years, they seem to be going up as fast as the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Maybe they're linked. At any rate, active hams who exchange paper QSL cards use the two bureaus to exchange QSL cards. But there are a number of problems. First, not all countries have QSL bureaus, and all that do are staffed by volunteers who do the work of forwarding QSL cards occasionally. All have limits on the number of cards they'll forward at a time. If you are a relatively inactive ham, cards can linger in each country's bureau for months, with some countries being notoriously slower than others at doing the forwarding. It can take years to exchange some cards, a consideration if you really need a certain country or DXCC entity for the various awards. There's always the option to send a card directly through the mail. Well, not always. A surprising number of countries don't have reliable mail service. Some are so bad that hams living in those countries advise against sending QSL cards direct. Many of those same countries don't have QSL bureaus either, so active hams in those countries use a QSL manager, a designated amateur in a third country with reliable postal service to which you will send your QSL card. The DX ham in the country with poor mail service can send his or her on-air contact logs via email to the manager, who, when your card comes in, will check your card with the DX ham's log and send back a QSL stamped with a third-party ham's verification. Though there was a time that QSL managers did the forwarding free, that's no longer always the case. You might be expected to send green stamps, U.S. dollars, along with your QSL card. DX hams typically put this information on their QRZ.com webpage. To do this relatively safely, you should send a nested SASE with the green stamps inside that envelope, which is inside the envelope addressed to the manager. I have always used security envelopes that make it hard to see if there is cash in the envelope. This worked surprisingly well. I don't recall an instance when a reply card was not received, and over the years I've probably sent hundreds. In olden times, you could send an International Reply Coupon, IRC, a slip of paper you would purchase at your local post office. This would be sent to the ham or the manager, who would be able to convert it to their local postage and send your QSL on the way. IRCs have not been used for many years, so these other methods have been devised. A good source for finding QSL managers for the DX you might have worked is IK3QAR.IT/manager. In the case of Cuban hams, since there is no postal service between our countries, though we are only 90 miles apart, QSL managers work well. I have probably dozens of Cuban QSL cards, though regrettably none from the late Arnie Curro, CO2KK. The least expensive and fastest way to receive a paper QSL will be to use a U.S.-based QSL manager. You need only send your card along with an SASE to the stateside manager, and the total cost will be 2 first-class stamps. Most DX hams will note on their QRZ.com webpage the best way to QSL the contact. DXpeditions may send out tens of thousands of cards each year, so they don't need yours. To receive a paper card from DXpeditions without sending your own, it's best to use clublog.com. It's an ingenious way to check to make sure you are actually in the DXpeditions log and to be able to pay for the cost of sending a paper QSL card directly to you. Costs to do so will be explained, and you can pay with credit card or PayPal. But suppose you don't want paper QSL cards, and you're just needing to confirm contacts and get to the various awards quickly. You can use arrl.org/logbook-of-the-world. This is the most used method of QSLing today because you can receive confirmation of a contact almost instantly. LOTW keeps track of your contacts for purposes of receiving DXCC awards. The ARRL, which administers LOTW, notes, there is no fee for obtaining a call sign certificate, submitting QSOs, or using one's LOTW account to view submitted QSOs, confirmed QSOs, or award progress. A fee is only charged when submitting confirmed QSOs for award credit. LOTW has saved thousands of dollars for each individual ham seeking various awards, especially today, as a first-class U.S. postage stamp, as of this writing, and apparently subject to change by the month, 73 cents, good only for mail within U.S. borders. Even if you are using a stateside QSL manager, you're out $1.46 plus the cost of each printed QSL card in 2 envelopes. To send directly to a DX country, including our dear neighbors in Canada and Mexico, the first class postage cost is $1.65. But with only 73 cent forever stamps in your desk drawer, you'll have to send 3 first class stamps costing $2.19. You'll be wasting 54 cents with each DX card you send. Instead, use the USPS's Forever International stamps. You have a choice between the African Daisy stamp and the Poinsettia stamp. But you may still need to nest a couple of green stamps. Some require as much as $5 if you expect the other ham to reciprocate, though there are some who will return your green stamps with their card. Amazingly, some DX hams state flatly on their QRZ.com page that they will not send QSL cards for any reason. You can quickly see why LOTW is so popular. To achieve DXCC, verify 100 DX entities, by direct mail today, you'll have to spend almost $400 per 100 DX entities, $3.30 U.S. postage, plus the cost of the QSL card, typically 40 to 60 cents each, and two security envelopes, 10 cents, a total of almost $4 per DX entity. The downside to LOTW is that you don't have the interesting paper QSLs, so prized by hams in the 20th century, and displayed by covering the walls of their radio room. The loss of patience. The pursuit of DXCC entities used to be a lifelong process. It took a lot of hanging around on all bands to work your first 100 DXCC entities, and over the years, an individual might gradually get 300 of the 340 official DXCC entities if they were diligent. Filling in your logbook with DX contacts, writing out the QSL cards, and sending them off to the bureau and waiting patiently for their return. Collecting your cards in boxes to be carried to a nearby hamfest, where an officially appointed card counter would scrutinize your collection. Tossing out ones that didn't count. Maybe there was a typo or other potentially fraudulent mark on the card. Maybe the DX you worked is no longer considered a DX entity. Maybe the DXpedition you worked failed to get approval as an official DXpedition. Maybe there were duplicate cards. Once you filled out the paperwork and further officials scrutinized your application, a certificate would be issued and mailed. You might get it framed and put it on the wall of your shack. That has all changed. Today, there seems to be an urgency to get that work done. DX spotting websites such as DX Heat let you see which DX entities are on, which bands they are operating on, and how they are being received around the world. Modern rigs show on the spectrum or waterfall display how they are coming into your location and if they're working split or simplex. LOTW has taken the pain out of the painstaking process of doing DXCC paperwork and necessary verification by authorities. And modes such as FT8 have taken the weariness of hanging around on all the bands to work your first 100 DXCC entities. I can understand that. The older we come to this hobby, the more urgent it seems to achieve these milestones. It's amazing to look back and see how things have changed in the QSLing aspect of this hobby. 100 years ago, the federal government printed the list of all radio amateurs. 50 years ago, a bustling business was made in the publication of commercially printed call books. And as an active ham, you needed to have the latest edition at your fingertips so you could send off your QSL cards. Less than 30 years ago, those bulky New York City phone directory-sized books were replaced by CD-ROMs, which were quickly replaced by the ad-supported website QRZ.com. I have never heard of anyone who regretted the change. It seems that the expense of producing and exchanging QSL cards has outstripped their importance. That makes websites such as OnTheShortWaves.com, that has preserved historic QSLs as part of radio history, so important. It's too bad that website will soon disappear. Has preservation of this part of radio history outlived its importance? It's lucky that there is one other source for historic QSLs, nationalradioclub.org/QSLs. And now, Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z, NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. More vintage radio tidbits. Sometimes, thinking about the subject of safety reminds me of being forced to watch Leonard Bernstein educational films in middle school. My fellow miscreants hated the thought so much that we would sneak into the music room, where these masterpieces of musical and culture were shown. And before class, we would remove the wall plate on the electrical socket that powered the projector, rendering it unable to play the film. Oh well, let's save Leonard Bernstein for another day. Looking back, even this act of early teen rebellion was a safety issue in and of itself. You see, I was an electronics miscreant, but one of my fellow classmates who held Maestro Bernstein in a similar low regard was an electrical miscreant, as his father was an actual electrician, and he had some idea of how to safely disconnect the wires on the side of the electrical outlet before putting the wall plate back on without getting shocked or tripping a breaker. His specialty topped mine in that case, so he naturally took the risk. To this day, I have a knowledge gap when it comes to Leonard Bernstein and other great American composers and playwrights. And I'm okay with it, and thankfully, I've caught up in the electrical safety department. Nowadays, having survived a very dynamic childhood, and having become a ham of a certain age, I'm all about safety. Last month, I detailed my recently constructed dim bulb tester, designed to protect me when working on line-powered AC amplifiers, radios, and other devices. This month, we'll explore additional tidbits related to safely using and restoring vintage gear, not necessarily in a logically structured order. I can't cover every relevant topic in this column, as books have been written about the subject, and a great many fantastic YouTube channels and websites address these topics in great detail. I can, however, point you toward getting the info that you need to get started, or to motivate you to move forward with restoration projects that might have been sitting on your bench for years or decades. If you'd like to work with vintage electronics, staying safe isn't difficult, but it is necessary. And so is good information. It's 1955 all over again. Although a bit before my time, 1955 seems to be sending me shortwave radios. I picked up a Hallicrafter's S85 last winter for a few meager bucks on Craigslist. Although the seller insisted that he used it to listen to local AM stations, I haven't powered it up yet, as I was waiting to finish my dim bulb tester, which is now complete. Before I could line things up, however, a national SW54 showed up in a similar fashion. The seller had been posting the radio for nearly 2 years at a price of $200, which is the very top end for a set like this, but only in fully restored collector condition. This one was very clean externally for a 69-year-old radio, but the unit had definitely not been restored. I offered $50, still a bit high, but was turned down. I checked in on the radio's listing every now and then, all the while marveling at the sustained asking price. One day, however, the listing was slashed from $200 to $29. The seller was moving overseas and was now shedding inventory. I pulled the trigger and bought the little beauty back to the shack. It's purdy on the outside, but nasty on the inside. Before I can safely apply power, even via a dim bulb tester with current limiting features, I have to replace the paper electrolytics and the wax capacitors that are in bad shape, which is probably every single one. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.